Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
WNYC.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We dip into a lot of records on this show, but did you ever stop to wonder why or how all these records get made? Sometimes they're a way for an artist to try something new, like Natalie Dawn. She's half of the viral video duo Pomplamoose. Their version of Single Ladies has almost 10 million hits on YouTube. One quick-witted commenter wrote, "I heard Beyoncé did a cover of this." But using a fan funding site, Natalie Dawn has made a solo record with some very different music, which she'll play here in our studio. Some other records are a blatant attempt to cash in on celebrity, your own or someone else's. And on a day full of hoaxes and other April Fool's Day pranks, we'll hear John Flansburgh of the group They Might Be Giants unmasking some memorable attempts at fake Beatlemania. And of course, there are many other reasons that artists make albums, but there's one reason that most of them don't like to talk about. When you make an album, because you have to. Last week, we heard some of the new album from The Strokes. Called Come Down Machine, it marks the band's fifth album, and as Grantland writer Stephen Hayden pointed out on the show, it wraps up the band's five-album contract with RCA Records. Now, whether or not The Strokes did this album just to fulfill a contract, we may never know. But there have been plenty of instances of bands or artists that have put out some, well, rather unusual records just to fulfill their legal obligations. Joining me here in the studio to talk about them are Ben Greenman, editor for The New Yorker. Ben, welcome back.
Hi, John.
And Christine LaPera, entertainment attorney from the firm Mitchell, Silberberg & Knupp, LLP. Hi, Christine.
Hey, John.
Let me start with you because Ben and I actually started talking about this last time Ben was here.
Okay.
After the show was over, we started talking about, you know, contractual obligation records and stuff.
Right.
And when we asked you to be on the show, your first response was?
My first response was, what? Contractual obligations? That's unheard of in the record business.
Well, they're all contractual obligations.
That's exactly what my, well, for the most part. I think that's a fair statement. I think you can look at the majority of artists, certainly the most successful ones, and you can be fairly safe to say that they have all contracted in some fashion with an entity or a corporation to manufacture and distribute their recordings and give up certain rights in that process.
In return for which they get presumably piles of cash.
Piles.
All right.
Otherwise known as royalties.
So in a kind of conventional contractual situation between an artist or band and a record label, what are we talking about? Is it usually you do your first record and then?
There are a variety of different permutations, obviously. But one typical example is artist signs to do a minimum commitment of certain number of albums, and this can span over a period of years, and it could be, for example, one album per option period, and then there can be layers of options that may be exercised or not by the record label. So there can be quite a number of years that the artist is under contract with the label in this permutation.
Okay. So, Ben, when we were talking earlier, the last time you were on the show, about contractually obligated records, we both, and I think everyone listening probably, understood that to mean something very specific.
Right. I think it's a little bit of a misnomer. It's not, the obligation's not the issue. It's the end of the obligation. And the fulfillment, sometimes churlishly or sometimes, disrespectfully, of the end of the term of the contract. And it's artists, I guess, feeling as though they need to deliver out one album, in some cases I'm sure we'll talk about this later, but there's the classic trick of the live double album to meet units. And they, because their contract calls for, you know, five albums of material, they do three, they're unhappy, and then it's time for them to get ready to go. And it's just, I guess the question is, or one of the things that we should talk about is, artistic inspiration sometimes seems subtracted from that, and they're only trying to fulfill the contract. You assume in other cases that they're trying to balance it. They're fulfilling the contract, but also doing what they want as artists. And then the question comes, what if you take that part out, doing what you want as an artist, and all they have to do is meet the letter of the contract? What do you get? And we have some great examples of that in rock history.
And maybe not even in rock history. Why don't we start in the world of comedy with Monty Python's Contractual Obligation album, which is called Monty Python's Contractual Obligation Album.
Here comes a bunch of them. Here comes another one. Thank God I'm not having lunch with them.
That's it, is it?
Obviously, it would be better with a full orchestra.
Yes. Yes, I suppose it would.
Here comes another one from Monty Python, from their Monty Python's Contractual Obligation album of 1980, which they did simply to fulfill a contract with Charisma Records that they wanted to get out of. We're talking about examples of contractual obligation records, and if there's one that you'd like to point out to us, you can leave a comment on our website, soundcheck.org. Christine, is it easier for an artist who wants to get out of a contract to just go into the studio and do any old thing for a couple of hours and send it to the record label than it is to actually go to court and try and win their freedom, so to speak?
Well, I think going to court, obviously, for anyone, it's ripe with uncertainty, and you have a long-term commitment to litigation that, you know, the outcome is uncertain, certainly, and it's expensive. So if you have a situation where you can't resolve a dispute, and oftentimes there are renegotiations or there's efforts to resolve a dispute between the parties, I mean, that's obviously the best course for both sides, if that can be accomplished. If not, and there's another commitment left and then the contract's over, it does have to be done, assuming the contract's going to be enforced. So you get to it, I presume,
you know,
in the absence of some other resolution, either litigation or settlement. You get to that. And how that's done, I guess that depends on the particular person who's doing it and a lot of factors.
Well, and there, Ben, we get to some of the great examples of people who have found themselves in this situation and just wanted to get out of that contract.
What's interesting, too, is that over the course of a career, particularly a successful career, artists have a entertainer persona that becomes attached to them. Their fans see them a certain way, and the record label wants the fans to keep seeing them that way. And the most common case, and there are some very violent examples of this, is that the artist uses that as an opportunity to go the other way in some cases, to deliver something that couldn't possibly be profitably grouped with the way that they're seen as a popular artist, and they're trying to stick it to the label. And the most famous case of this type of thing is Van Morrison, who was signed to Bang Records, which was a label run by Burt Burns. And over the course of Van Morrison's career with Bang, Burt Burns alienated him repeatedly. He released records when Van was out on the road without telling him. He overproduced them. And Van Morrison got angrier and angrier and angrier, and there came a time when he wanted to get out. Burt Burns died suddenly, and he owed them, I believe, 20 copyrights of new material. And he went into the studio and took his guitar and just stream of consciousness insulted people and made things up and talked about what was on his mind at that time. Usually the same chord, I believe. I'm not a musicologist, but he and Burt Burns' widow at the time didn't want to pursue it because she had young children. She was recently widowed, and so she just let it go. And it's become this incredibly strange collectible in rock history because it's a major artist just going out there and seemingly unraveling, although it's in fact the opposite. He was exerting incredible control over the process by delivering this. It's not a breakdown. It's the opposite. It's a breakup.
It's Van Morrison fulfilling the letter of the law, the letter of the contract, but maybe not the spirit. The Bang sessions are also known as the contract-breaking sessions by Van Morrison. This is not Van at his high watermark, but give a listen to this song, which has a pretty typical title for this session. It's called Ringworm.
I can see by the look on your face that you've got ringworm. I'm very sorry, but I have to tell you that you've got ringworm. It's a very common disease. Actually, you're very lucky to have ringworm, because you may have had something else.
Terrific.
Now, we're all having a good laugh at that here in the studio. Ringworm by Van Morrison, who flubs a chord and cannot even be bothered to stop and do an edit, you know, just... So he's simply out to give his old record label the 20 or so songs. Actually, I think it was 36 that he owed them to fulfill his contract and be able to move on. Christine, does a record company have any legal recourse when an artist does, in fact, fulfill the letter of the contract by delivering something like that?
Well, there's always, in, you know, at least in New York, an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing in every contract. And you wonder, you know, whether or not, if this had been debated, I take it was not, and they accepted it, but I don't know. If it, you know, if it was challenged,
I think what they ended up doing is they just didn't release it.
Yeah, and so, but they let him walk and let him move on, so his exclusivity was no longer in place. Okay, yeah. So yeah, you have to look at that, and then if someone's going to challenge it and say, essentially, this is not even something that's arguably protectable under copyright. I mean, the lyric is nothing. The chord is nothing.
I mean, you know, I think of Neil Young, who got in trouble with his own record label in the 80s without having, you know, to like finish out a contract. It's just because the label was saying, these don't sound like Neil Young records. You know, they were very angry at him. I guess thinking that maybe he wasn't making the records in good faith or something.
There's a long history, and it's related to this, of albums and artists coming to blows over what we mentioned before, which is the label's perception of the artist and the artist's perception of themselves. And as they deviate from that, you have a lot of cases where albums say, this isn't a you record. This isn't what we expected from you. That's a somewhat different issue. The thing that's interesting about the Van Morrison, and I guess this is to Christine's point, is that there is a legal and even philosophical question underlying this, which is, what's a song? Like, you do have these are – it certainly was original. You can't, you know
– Certainly it was. Nothing like it before.
Nothing like it before or since. And potentially useful for children. Get yourself checked, kids. You could have it. But it's – right. Was he doing anything when he was signed to be what we knew then and know now, you know, one of the greatest – modern rock R&B visionary poet songwriters, and this is what he produces? Who's to say? People do bad work all the time,
but not usually intentionally.
That's right.
What's an interesting point is, you know, do you cut off your nose to spite your face, kind of thing? Because artists are obviously one of the things that compels them the most is to produce the best possible work and to keep working on their craft.
Yeah,
so
I wonder,
you have this tension there between, you know, I want to get something done and I don't care if I sound like garbage. You really are hurting yourself almost more than anyone.
Which raises the question. I wonder what Van Morrison now thinks of when, you know, these tapes, which he thought the record company would never put out correctly, have finally come out. And, you know, people hear this and say, that's Van Morrison singing about ringworm? And he's not even really singing? And
it's a great comedy record, first of all. I mean, unintentionally, perhaps. But there is this question of artists and the uncomfortable relationship with commerce. And another example... when Graham Parker was signed to Mercury in the 70s, and he increasingly felt they weren't promoting him, they weren't giving him tour support, and he owed them a record, two records, I think. And he released the Parkerilla, which is a double... It's actually one of the most aggressive things you can do, which is the three-sided double album, where you give three sides and the back of the second disc is nothing. I mean, on CD, you can't see this, but it's just, a smooth fourth side. And got him out of it. He fulfilled the contract, went off and recorded a song called Mercury Poisoning, which is all about how Mercury treated him badly.
Right.
No more pretending that an albatross is dying in its nest. The company is crippling me to worse, trying to ruin the best. A death promotion so lame, they could never ever take it to the real ball game. Maybe they
a great song. I mean, it really, it's a high
water.
It's
fatal and it don't get better. Yeah, I remember
fantastic.
That song.
And that's, you know, to Christine's point, you want the artist to present themselves best, but the other thing artists do is they keep their antenna up and they, with some sensitivity and ability to form this, they report what's happening to them. Well, what if what's happening to them is that they're in a miserable situation with their company? That's a reality. And it, you know, it might seem trivial in retrospect, Van Morrison, but it's actually in a weird way universal. People have bad relationships with their jobs, with their spouses, with their mm-hmm. families. And in a strange way, this frustration, and I think that's the enduring appeal of the Van Morrison, people kind of like this anti-hero move to go in with the guitar and say, oh, you want 36 songs from me? Here you go.
Well, you know, the example of mercury poisoning by Graham Parker sort of, you know, flipping the bird at his old record label is, you know, that's one example of an artist sort of getting back at a label after he's been able to walk away. But we're mostly focusing on albums that come as a result of needing to get to that point where you can walk away from your old label. Ben Greenman's with me, editor for The New Yorker, Christine LaPera, entertainment attorney with Mitchell Silberberg and Nup LLP. And again, listeners, you can leave us your example of a contractual obligation record on our website, soundcheck.org. What about another of the most famous examples? Lou Reed's Metal Machine Music, which is just, you know, to many people, just this kind of unlistenable experiment in loud electronic noise, but which Lou Reed to this day stands by as a kind of, you know, noble attempt at musical experimentation.
I think that you do have another case where artists get near the end of their contracts and they want to try something. The Lou Reed album is an example of something that could not have happened, I suppose, when the contract was active, or would have been difficult, because you go from that to what? It's an end game. But, you know, I think that's how the Book of Revelation happened. Same thing. They needed one more book for the Bible, and that's the one that happened. And so that might...
You're not allowed off that island until you give us one more book.
Yeah, John of Patmos, they said to him, you know, you got to finish this up, and then you're free to go. And I do think that this whole dialogue of liberation and captivity is maybe too strong a word, but obligation, let's say, and liberation.
Not too strong a word for Prince, who had the word slave written on his face when he wanted out of his contract.
Yeah, and contracts, and Christine can attest to this, are tricky things because artists often don't have a very good sense of them beyond the fact that they enable them to make the thing that they care about. Some right. artists do, but a lot of artists don't. Pete Townsend used to say that the thing he loved, in a way, about becoming famous with The Who is that he had a commission for his work, and that when they became less famous, it was hard for him to generate material. In a way, the lack of that obligation hurt his creativity because they weren't drawing from him. But there's a flip side to that, and Prince is an example of that. What if they bleed you dry?
Yeah.
Well, another thing that happens just also is the longevity and the length of these terms of contract, because artists create when they create, and to actually say, okay, we're going to get in the studio, we're going to get an album done in 2 or 3 months, and so then with the options and everything moves more quickly, it's a longer release period sometimes, and so you're dealing with years, potentially, of a relationship, especially under the older scenarios of contractual relationships.
Which is an interesting point, the idea that you can somehow legally obligate somebody to be creative at a certain point in time.
Well, you don't.
It's time for you to create now.
Or it just continues. In other words, yeah. The length of the time is not necessarily prescribed, but you know, you can continue longer and longer than you may have anticipated, and you may be changing as an artist, and there's all these variables that come into place.
The other case, though, is this immediacy, which is a real interesting case. And the thing that Christine just mentioned, which is about the immediacy of creation, which is you can pull an artist in and create sometimes even different circumstances for creating, just as a result of certain kinds of contracts.
Mm-hmm. So a famous example of that would be Marvin Gaye, who found himself kind of forced into the studio, not necessarily by record company obligations, but because he had gotten divorced and needed money to pay alimony.
Right.
Although his wife was related to the record company owner somehow. So there was – the record company was involved in this.
Right. It's a Gordy sibling. And they – I mean, the deal there is that's a settlement record more than contractual obligation.
Yeah.
But it's a very interesting related case, which is he needed money, and the judge said the next album that you create, the royalties will go to your ex-wife.
Right.
And so he made an album about the divorce, and it's a very great I think, strange record, but a great record in a lot of ways, because the sense of being in that moment, and this question we've been asking all along, which is, why do artists create? Because there's money on the table, because a line in a contract says so, or because they have to. This is a have-to record, and the urgency of it is really palpable through the whole record, and it's very strange as a soul music record.
And it's called, somewhat bitterly, Here, My Dear.
You know, when you say your marriage vows, they're supposed to be for real. I mean, if you think back about what you really said, you know, about honor and loving and obeying until death do us part, no. But it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be lies, because though it turns out to be lies, if you don't honor what you said, you've lied to God. Words should be changed. Now as I recall, we tried a million times, again, and that isn't all. I gave my love to you each time to make amends.
That is Marvin Gaye with When Did You Stop Loving Me? When Did I Stop Loving You? From his album Here, My Dear, the record he was bound legally to make to raise alimony payments for his ex-wife, hence the title Here, My Dear. The difference between that, Ben, and the Van Morrison is he can't help himself, Marvin Gaye. He's going to sing, that voice goes into action, and your ears just are immediately drawn to him.
And there's a very, throughout the record, there's this narrative that goes, and there are parts that are arranged like doo-wop songs to recall the beginning. There's this sort of 70s funk song to look toward the future, where he goes out into space with his new lover in the song. Yeah. Like, he didn't literally go into space. But, yeah, I mean, the difference is that I guess Van Morrison is more, it's a totally different personality. There's a famous American Bandstand where he's singing Brown Eyed Girl. Van Morrison is absolutely refusing to lip sync plausibly, looking at the camera, scowling. It's just a different, you know, balance between the entertainer and the artist.
Yep. Now, you mentioned Todd Rundgren, who was trying to get out of his record contract with Bearsville Records. He put out an album called The Ever-Popular Tortured Artist Effect, which, you know, along with Lyle Lovett singing Release Me, you know, is a pretty obvious message to his fans about what is going on here. It's kind of this wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know, I'm making this record because I have to sort of thing. And yet somehow, as we found, they end up making good records maybe despite themselves. We've been talking about the contractual obligation record with Ben Greenman of The New Yorker and with entertainment attorney Christine LaPera. And to the two of you, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me, John.
Thank
it's
you.
Fun.
From that Todd Rundgren record, here is a song he couldn't even bother to write. It's a cover of a Small Faces tune called Tin Soldier. Now, most misheard lyrics aren't quite so significant. In fact, most of them are just plain fun. And that's what we'll be doing in our special live call-in show on Soundcheck tomorrow night at 9. So do join us then and be prepared to share your favorite Mondegreen or misheard lyric. Up next, Natalie Dawn is one half of Pamplemousse, a duo known for their YouTube videos. She'll play songs from her new solo album in our studio. And later, a look back at musical hoaxes with John Flansburgh of They Might Be Giants.
Paris Sally was the fairest of them all. She was born in the month of Gemini. To every man who saw her befell Cupid's curse.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. DIY works well for singer Natalie Dawn. Her duo Pamplemousse, with multi-instrumentalist and singer Jack Conte, rose to fame with a bunch of homemade YouTube covers of pop songs. Then, when she asked her fans to raise $20,000 to fund her debut solo album, she ended up with more than $100,000. The resulting album, called How I Knew Her, is out now. And today, Natalie Dawn is here with us in the studio, along with banjo player Ryan Lerman, to play some of those songs for us. The first one is called Leslie. Here's Natalie Dawn live on Soundcheck.
Fine dust falls from steel pipelines like ashes from a pharaoh's tomb, shaking off bad luck of baby's dreams that never left the womb. Many things are wired to avoid short circuits, but not us, for we are far too human, too human. Leslie rides on Ferris wheels way up in the umbrella clouds. She is not afraid of falling out of favor with the crowds. Lord, oh Lord, please bless her soul and bless her mother. Shine your face on us, for we are human, too human. Do your best, little girl, and have a little fun, 'cause life wears you down and takes you for a run. Do your best, little girl, and have a little fun, 'cause life wears you down and takes you for a run. Run, run, little girl, run, run, little girl, run, run, little girl, run, 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 little girl, run, run, little girl, run, run, little girl, run, 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 run.
That's called Leslie, a song from Natalie Dawn, who you heard singing and playing the guitar. You also heard Ryan Lerman singing and playing the banjo. The song appears on Natalie's new record called How I Knew Her. Natalie, welcome to Soundcheck.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I mentioned in the intro that, you know, you did the Kickstarter thing where you do fan funding for the album, and you ended up raising a lot more than you had even anticipated.
Sure did.
Some of that money went to do videos for all of the songs on the record,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, actually. I set aside a pretty big portion of the budget, about a quarter of the budget, so that we could have a professional film crew in there filming the whole recording process, and so that I could use those terabytes and terabytes of footage afterwards to edit together music videos for all of the songs on the album. Mm-hmm. And I've actually already put out one of those music videos for this song. And then after that, after I put out the music video for Leslie, the label decided that it would be nice to actually have a bona fide music video. So we went back and revisited that song and actually made a music video.
So it's now there's a second.
There's going to be a second music video coming out. That's right.
For
next
Leslie.
Month.
Well, now, you know, folks who know you as half of Pomplamoose will know that you've been sort of visually inclined anyway, you know, with you and Jack having done all those videos on YouTube.
It's true. It's been pretty much a constant stream of music and videos for the last 5 years.
Your version of Single Ladies has something like 10 million views and stuff, which might have led people to expect a different kind of record from what what you actually ended up putting out.
Yeah, you know, Pomplamoose tends to stay pretty lighthearted in our music. That's the wonderful thing about Pomplamoose is that it's an outlet for us. It's something fun that Jack and I do. People are often surprised when they hear our solo music and find it to be, in both of our cases, quite a bit darker and more introspective than what we do with Pomplamoose. And it's a good thing that it is, you know, because you can't be all light and rainbows and, you know, sugar cookies as right. much as I'd like to be. Yeah.
Now, the case in point, the album title, How I Knew Her, the title track, How I Knew Her, seems to be, the narrator is singing to perhaps an older woman, maybe suffering with Alzheimer's or something. The question of memory and the loss of the transmission of memory from one generation to another seems to be behind that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I delve into some pretty, I guess, difficult topics in that song. It's one that's particularly close to home for me. The title track is actually told from my mom's perspective, speaking to her mom. As you aptly noted, it is about loss of memory and feeling like you've lost someone who you never really got the chance to know because they were always sort of playing a role. They were always fulfilling a role.
And at some point, you reach the realization that even though this person is sort of here in front of me, they're really gone at this point.
They're gone. Yeah. There's no way you're going to get them back. Yeah.
So, there are dark moments, some of them couched in very lively and very... almost frolicsome music, which is another part of this album.
Yeah, absolutely. There's light and dark in the album. I think Jack did a wonderful job. It's funny, this isn't a Pomplamoose album, but I still had him produce the album. Mm-hmm. And so he handled all of the orchestration and did a wonderful job just sort of bringing up the mood, I would say, with horns and strings and things like that.
And horns and strings notwithstanding, there's also lots of the kind of roots Americana sounds here.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and if you're going to talk about dark, I mean, you talk about Appalachian ballads and old bluegrass hollers. Some of that stuff is seriously dark.
Yeah.
Were you kind of dipping into that well?
Yeah. It's, and it's got, some of the songs have a bit of a Tom Waitsy vibe to them.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tom Waits sort of conjures up this image of, the wandering minstrel, a guy who may have no fixed address, doesn't know where his next drink is coming from. You grew up the child of missionaries, right? So you did a lot of wandering around as a kid.
I did. We were a bit of a traveling circus growing up, actually. My parents were missionaries, and in order for us to live overseas in Europe where they were ministering to, we lived in France and Belgium for 8 years from ages 10 to 18 for me. In order to afford that lifestyle, we had to have people supporting us, and in order to gain support from churches and people, we would travel during the summer times, just sort of church hopping, and it was very much a nomad lifestyle. In fact, I had a Sega Nomad, so that should tell you it was a while ago.
So your family was fan-funding their missionary work.
Kind of. I guess you could call it fan-funding, honestly, I think it's far more of a struggle than what I ended up doing on Kickstarter, because the nice thing about that is that people actually wanted to hear my music, and I wasn't just interrupting their Sunday service with a plea for money. So it was slightly different.
Well, now, how do you find the life of a touring musician? I mean, you're itinerant once again.
I am. And it's strange, because Pomplamoose has done virtually no touring. Any touring that we've done has been very successful, but we don't go out on the road very often. And the reason we don't is because it's expensive. It's really expensive to be on the road. And it's easier for us to make a living as musicians by just continuing to put out more music and MP3s and make a living off of downloads, basically.
You realize, of course, that what you are saying right now is like absolutely the opposite of what most musicians come in here and say, which is, I can't make money off of downloads because it's everyone's getting it for free, so I have to make money by being on the road.
Yeah, no, that's never been the case for us. And I think the reason is because we have this incredible core fan base on YouTube, and they want us to be able to keep making music. And there's a very close relationship with those people. It's not, you know, it's not like Beyonce. It's not like somebody who's signed to a label who's sort of untouchable. People think of us as real people who need to make a living, and consequently they support us.
Yeah.
And it's been fantastic, and you're very right, abnormal.
We're speaking with Natalie Dawn, who you may know as half of the duo Pomplamoose. Her solo record is called How I Knew Her. Everyone's calling this your solo debut, but there was another solo thing that you did.
There is. I actually called it her earlier stuff.
That's the name of the record.
That's the name of the record because it was a compilation of actually mostly audio taken from video camera. So it was when, you know, in the very early stages of YouTube when... the only reason I was putting out those songs was because people on YouTube were asking for them after the videos had gotten, you know, thousands of hits. They were like, I want to have this on my MP3 player. So I put out an album, and it does not sound nearly as professional as the one that I just put out.
The new record's called How I Knew Her. Natalie Dawn is with us here on Soundcheck. You want to do Back to the Barracks next?
That would be fantastic, yeah. Speaking of Tom Waitsy vibe.
Yeah, I like the way this song ends, too. I don't know if it's different in this setting than it is on the record, but it kind of goes someplace.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
Natalie Dawn and Ryan Lerman, once again, live on Soundcheck.
Shot you in the arm, it was intentional or unintentional. My thoughts were unaware. This isn't our first wound, it'll look smaller in the morning when the light reveals the bigger wound still there. We get 3 good days and it's back to the barracks. Yeah, it's back to the barracks, feeling anxious, feeling bad. We get 3 good days and it's back to the barracks, wondering if there could be better days ahead. Was it long ago we walked in fields of green? There were no minds between the places where we roamed. Now we just tiptoe as we both wait to cast the first stone when those little goddamn minds begin to blow. We get 3 good days, then it's back to the barracks. Yeah, it's back to the barracks, feeling anxious, feeling bad. We get 3 good days, then it's back to the barracks, wondering if there could be better days ahead. Ooh. You shot me in the arm, I saw your face grow pale, and we both knew so well that nothing had been won. We're trigger worn and wary, and the only thing that scares me is the thought that one of us could die alone. And it's back to the barracks, wondering if there could be better days. I know there could be better days, so here's to all those better days ahead.
Back to the Barracks is the song from Natalie Dawn. You'll find it on her new album, How I Knew Her. That's a live performance here in the Soundcheck studio from Natalie and Ryan Lerman. playing for us in the Soundcheck studio. This next song is called I Just Wanted You to Get Old, another from Natalie Dawn, live on Soundcheck.
I just wanted you to get old, like the army green Volvo and the toys we sold, like the books that you read me and the jokes you told. I just wanted you to get old. I just wanted you to get old, like vacations in Tahoe and your skiing poles, the ones I held on too tightly till you said let go. Oh, I just wanted you to get old. I'm sorry that I never get around to picking up the phone or staying home. I swear to God that I must be the worst person I've found. Tell me, would it be too late to appreciate you? I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. 'Cause I still want you to get old. Please forgive me. I know it doesn't always show, but I'll try to be better if you don't let go. Oh, I just want you to get old.
Once again, a song from Natalie Dawn, I Just Wanted You to Get Old. That's on her new album called How I Knew Her. Live performance here in the studio with Ryan Lerman on banjo. And Natalie playing a parlor guitar. So now these are instruments that were common in America in the late 19th, early 20th century, and they have, Natalie, a very kind of intimate sound.
They do. They do have a very intimate sound. It's funny because this is a super tone. It's from about 1915, it was actually made by Sears and Roebuck. So.
Right. You used to order mandolins, guitars. People would order those through the Sears Roebuck catalog.
Sears.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird? I think they should go back to
that.
Really, I think
they should.
They missed their calling.
Yeah. And people still play these instruments.
Yeah, they do. I mean, if you're lucky enough to find one, the problem is not that they're expensive. They're just few and far between.
Yeah. You talked before about, you know, being raised the child of missionaries and wandering around there in France and Belgium, which, by the way, if you're going to be a missionary, there are worse places to spend your formative years than Europe.
Yeah, I was pretty lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you do a lot of singing and playing in church?
I did, actually. Even before we went over to France, I was always involved in all of the church, you know, pageants, Christmas pageants and things like that. And then when I was older, I did what was obviously the cool thing, which was to learn guitar and become a worship leader.
Because that's where the cool kids
that's
were.
That's what the cool kids do, at church, at least. So I did that, And yeah, it wasn't until I got to college, actually, and met Jack, that's where we met, that I started
the other half of
bass.
Pamplemousse.
Yeah, Jack Conti, the other half of Pamplemousse. That's when I started playing bass, and I realized when I write, I usually write with bass lines. So.
And at what point did your parents say, that's the devil's music you're playing there?
They've never said that, actually. They're wonderful and loving and have always supported my music. The funny thing is, actually, that that when I graduated from college, I was planning on doing the responsible thing. You know, I never majored in music in college because you know, you how do you make a living if you do that? But I did begin Pomplamoose while I was in college, and just as I was graduating, I had a position as in marketing lined up, and my dad called me up and said, you know, Natalie, you should really just take this time to focus on the band. Which is just ridiculous.
Way to go, Dad.
Yeah, right?
Good for him.
And so, yeah, my parents are the reason I'm still a musician today.
I just want to say for the record, Dad's rule. No matter what my daughter's saying. All right. Natalie Dawn, the album is called How I Knew Her. It's out now. Natalie, it's been a real pleasure having you perform along with Ryan for us here in the Soundcheck studio.
Oh, thank you.
This is Soundcheck.
They christened you the black sheep to keep the world from knowing what the rest of them did. Ooh, Caroline, you're not a beauty queen, unlike some other siblings.
In honor of April Fool's Day, John Flansburgh of the band They Might Be Giants will tell us about some great hoaxes in pop music history. Next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. As you may have noticed, April 1st is a day when you can't always believe everything you hear on the radio. Even the august news programs from NPR can't resist having a little April Fool's fun. But we can. We resist fun in all its forms on Soundcheck. And so, rather than pulling a hoax on you, we are going to reveal a few by going back into our archives for a visit from John Flansburgh, half of the band They Might Be Giants, a group that tries hard to resist fun themselves, though they don't always manage it. We started with this song, Lies, by the Knickerbockers, which was intended to sound like the Beatles, and as John Flansburgh told us, they did a really good job of it.
Many people thought that it actually was the Beatles, and it was a moment in rock where really not, where pretending you were from Britain really had a big payoff.
So, I mean, every field has its own urban legends and myths, you know, science, art, politics, whatever. But they seem to flourish particularly in the fertile ground of rock music. Why is that?
I mean, I think there have always been people who misrepresented themselves. I guess in the history, right from the beginning of recording, there were white blues men who pretended to be black blues men who pretended to be white, you know, all sorts of acts like crossing racial lines. But I think it really came into bloom during the psychedelic era. I mean, I think that the Bob Dylan motorcycle accident, the Paul McCartney, Paul is dead, mm-hmm. I buried Paul moment, is one of those things where it just culturally, I think it really helps when everyone under the age of 23 is high. when I was actually doing some research on the Paul is dead thing, just for my own personal. I do want to say, just the only hoax that is being perpetrated today is that I'm an expert on hoaxes. I'm just a music lover and musician and a fan of all this stuff.
Okay, so now you've put together a medley.
Yes.
Of some of the most enduring myths.
Yes,
in rock
music.
Yes,
these are the longest lived urban legends. These are things that, like, when you jump in the cab and they're playing the oldies radio, the cab driver will very authoritatively tell you this as fact. And there's kind of no way to stop these things, especially when it's, you know, these facts, these non-facts show up in newspapers so often. Roll the tape.
Let's start with
this, of course, is the Kingsmen.
Louie Louie,
a classic Seattle garage band, and, you know, one of the most played songs of all time. One of the strange things is people constantly think that there are swear words in this song, and I mean, sort of in the Mick Jagger tradition, it's easy to hear why, especially when we get to the first verse here. Yeah, I mean,
I have no idea what that is.
Yeah, he might as well. He could be swearing all he wants because who's going to bust him on it? Another urban legend that is absolutely, it's very sad and unfounded, but it was in the papers, and once it's in the papers, there's nothing you can do, Mama Cass choking on a ham sandwich. And I guess this was in the British papers, known for their thorough vetting of facts, but it's just, you know, kind of echoed throughout the world, and it's a sad thing, since she's so talented and kind of a beautiful person. And this is Puff the Magic Dragon by Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Yes.
This was written by a Cornell student, a 19-year-old named Leonard Lipton, who's
so
now...
under the 23-year-old cutoff for everyone being high,
exactly.
As you said before.
And he says it was not influenced by drugs. It was actually influenced by the poetry of Ogden Nash. He had just gotten back from a lecture, and it seems highly plausible. But I think there are many clues... the Johnny Papers line. There are many things about this that seem plausible, and it doesn't help when Newsweek magazine runs an article about drug-influenced songs and says that your song is influenced by drugs.
The Ohio Players. All right, so we're skipping to the mid-70s here.
Yes, this is one of the weirdest ones for me, because I've heard the story a million times, a million different ways, that somehow, somewhere in the recording studio or perhaps during the photo session, a woman was murdered. While this, and you know, say what is right, and evidently there's a scream on this record, a woman's scream on this recording that everyone believes is the sound of a woman being killed. Now this is a complete like Shaggy Dog story. There's a million different incarnations of it. Snopes.com has got a very good, you know, sort of goes through all the different versions you'll hear. I can't even hear the woman screaming, to be perfectly honest. So.
She's doing it in such a funky, booty-shaking way that it's
exactly.
Just fitting right in. All right, so what about this myth, and this is a recent one, that the band 311 are white supremacists? I mean, I can't imagine anyone actually hearing the music and thinking that, but go.
Well, it's strange because their music is so influenced by black music. I think it comes out of people simply trying to figure out what their name means.
Yeah.
And, you know, K being the 11th letter in the alphabet. You know, paranoid people love the numerology stuff. So
right.
311 is all they needed.
Three of the 11th
yes.
letter. Three
K's.
K.
All
right.
But there's nothing, you know, as I say, you know, you can't argue with a crazy mom.
Okay.
Put it in a song and it goes like, whoa, amber is the color of your energy.
The Beatles have proven to be a particular favorite among pranksters.
Well, they're a good band.
Yeah.
Right after, you know, the that sort of psychedelic moment, you start getting bootleg records. And bootleg records are the perfect vehicle for promoting hoaxes because they're sort of nefarious by nature. This piece of music is called Peace of Mind, and evidently, the story goes that it was an unmarked tape found in the trash behind Abbey Road, and it is one of the great lost Beatle recordings.
Maybe.
And the candle burns a flame to meet the sky. I leave the candle laughing, I turn my face to cry. A safety pin returns my smile. I nod a brief hello. While you are building molecules with your garden hoe. My compass lasts forever. These things repressed inside. One feels it almost instantly. Unless the numbers die. It's over, it's done, babe, I need it again. Just please, 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 don't keep me from begin. I need to hear.
Well. Are those, in fact, the Beatles, or just very clever imposters? My guest is John Flansburgh from the band They Might Be Giants, and Peace of Mind?
It's fake. It's actually not it's not fake. It's real. It's just not the Beatles. And this recording was actually back when collectability meant something. This was one of the most collectible things, but you just wouldn't hear it. You know, you'd hear about it.
Tell us about the Masked Marauders.
Well, this is a funny one. It was actually just as Rolling Stone was starting. There was a Bob Dylan bootleg that was reviewed very glowingly in Rolling Stone as, you know, having great cultural relevance. And basically, Greil Marcus wrote a review of a fake bootleg supergroup. Also an idea very much of that moment, where Mick Jagger, Paul McCartney, you know, who else? Bob Dylan,
everybody. John Lennon.
Yeah. And again, this is something that, you know, I think, you know, has been continuously on sale on a duped cassette in Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, ever since 1970. But the vinyl is available as well. And it's the band is called the Masked Marauders. And basically the hoax went so far as after the review was written, a band assembled and recreated fake songs to resemble what had been discussed in the Rolling Stone review.
So the fake review came first.
Yes.
And spawned the fake record.
That is the story of it.
Holy cow. All right, let's hear a little bit from the Masked Marauders. That's the Masked Marauders, the purported supergroup of Bob Dylan, Mick Jagger, John Lennon, Paul McCartney. Nice idea, not quite real. Our full conversation with John Flansburgh of They Might Be Giants about musical hoaxes is in the archives on our website, soundcheck.org. So join us back here tomorrow night, 9 o'clock, for a live call-in special on Mondegreens, or Misheard Lyrics. We're going to throw open the phone lines to hear your favorite misheard lyrics, and our guests Joe Levy and Sophie Harris of Time Out New York will tell us why Mondegreens sometimes make a good song even better. Plus, live music from the L.A. rock band Local Natives. See you back here at 9 tomorrow night for our live call-in special. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.